Perhaps you are familiar with the story of the Quaker and the kicking cow. You will remember how the cow kicked the Quaker in the face as he tried to milk, and how the cow put its foot in the milk bucket. Some of you have been there. And I need not describe for you your reaction to that experience. And how the cow then kicked over the bucket when it was about half full. But being a man of peace, the Quaker held his temper until the cow raised the right foot and kicked him in the side, sending him across the barn floor. With that, the Quaker walked around in front of the cow and, looking the cow in the eye, said, "Thou knowest that I am a man of peace, but what thou dost not know is that I am going to give thee to my Baptist brother-in-law, and he will give thee what thou deservest." Jesus talks about wrongs and revenge on the plane of the new birth. He doesn't make sense on any other plane. You simply cannot make any kind of sense out of this talk about turning the other cheek and going the second mile and loving your enemy. It just doesn't make sense, except on the plane of the new birth, of the new kind of life, the new quality of life, that eternal quality of life, which is the essence of the Christian's life. Now I turn to this passage and read it to you for several reasons. One, I am distressed by the readiness of our Baptist churches to go to court and there to determine their rights and secure redress from the wrongs that have been done them. I had a letter this week from an attorney, a layman up in Illinois, in which he was asking about his church, whether in the midst of controversies they were doing right in trying to adopt quickly constitution and bylaws that would protect them in the event there was litigation arising out of the controversy. I do not know the answer. I do not know the answer that to the questions that arise from the effort of my good friends in North Carolina to provide model church constitutions to prevent recurrences of the North Rocky Mount Baptist Church situation. I can tell you a better way, that is to baptize only Christians. That is one way to avoid these terrible dilemmas. Of course, there is still another step, but you wouldn't be interested in that because it doesn't... Well, I don't know. I was going to suggest that the churches might also try calling only Christians as pastors. That, too, would help in the midst of controversy, but that isn't really what Jesus is talking about here, and I'm taking you a bit afield But I simply wanted to take down what you already know about the action of the Christian, not at the level of revenge in the midst of wrong, but turning the other cheek, going the second mile. I shall not try to tell you what that means in a church controversy or in any controversy in which you are engaged. I shall leave that to you, but I do want to say something else that I got from a very unlikely source. I was sitting at a banquet table with then Vice President Alvin Barkley, now Senator Barkley. Now, I do not expect much in fresh exegesis from my politician friend, though every once in a while I discover that they have something rather worth listening to say about the Bible and about its meaning in the midst of the riptides of political life, and I'm always impressed. This I had not heard before. Senator Barkley said to the group, "You are not a free man until you go the second mile. The first mile you go because you are compelled to go. It is a forced experience that you do because you have to do it. But the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth mile, these are the roads traveled by free men. Only when you do what you are not compelled to do are you a free man." Now, you may find the origin of this particular message in yesterday's chapel. I had worked before chapel on something else, but when Pastor George Riggs said something about compulsory chapel attendance, I got off on a different track. And this is out of that, in part, at least. I spoke in chapel once down at Cumberland University. There they had a very wonderful system for compelling chapel attendance. It cost you a dollar if you were absent. The day I was there, those who were absent got a bargain, but sometimes they didn't. But maybe we ought to share with you why chapel attendance is not compulsory. May I drive this down? You can compel a man to go to church, but you cannot make him worship. By a school decree or a court order, you can make a man go into the assembly, but you can't make him worship. I was interested in my friend John Hurt, editor of the Christian Index of Georgia, taking editorial exception to the judgment of a court sentencing a man and his son to attend church for so many Sundays. And Editor Hurt said, "That isn't the way to do it. Really, we don't want people in church that way." I'm waiting to see my friend to ask him at what point we draw the line by the pressure we exert and promotion and advertising to get them into church, or by the pressure of pastors' orders or public opinion. You can get people there, but you just can't make them worship, can you? Now, don't misunderstand me. I probably would be given to a lot of advertising or public opinion or something else to get people into church. There is something about compelling them to come in and all of that. I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about
the thing that is beyond, where a man is always free. The second mile, if you please. And it's really only the second mile that counts, isn't it? There are a lot of things I wish about our school, our campus. I wish that all of our students attended all the chapel services to worship God. I wish that were true. From somewhere there pops into memory a story which I hope you already know, of the visitor who leaned over the back of the pew to whisper to the member of the church just before the service started, "Is the pastor going to be here today?" And the member, with more insight than most of us have, whispered back, "No, but God is." I wish that all of the members of our campus family attended all the chapel services to worship God. But you can't compel that, you know. I wish that our campus was blanketed with prayer meetings, but really, how much good would it do if we set up an administrative kind of procedure to promote and to create and to organize student prayer meetings until you just practically were ostracized if you didn't attend one of them? I wonder how much good it would do. I wish that our campus were blanketed with prayer meetings, not first mile prayer meetings, but the second mile kind. I wish that in our zeal for truths which are known with the mind, we might be consumed with zeal for truths which are experienced in the heart. I wish that were true. I was surveying or studying a theological seminary for accreditation recently, and I was almost amused because they were slightly embarrassed when, as we went to the classroom, we discovered that somebody, apparently a student committee, because it must have been done rather regularly from what we heard, had put some prayer suggestions on the blackboards in the classrooms. And the administration of that particular seminary explained that this did not mean that they were not academically concerned. My word, since when did the two things become contradictory anyway? Actually, I was quite impressed. Not by that little mechanical device. I had no objection to that at all, but I was impressed by the fact that obviously somebody somewhere, without any official sanction, much less promotion, had set about concerning himself with the spiritual temperature of his campus. That's the kind of second mile experience where you have to walk freely. You can't be compelled to walk. Over in the area of participation in the life of the seminary, you know, often I have the feeling that the seminary is a kind of cafeteria where you come and get what you want and go on about your business. Well, we might hire a basketball coach. I understand that one of the seminaries has recently done that. And stir up some school spirit. Maybe we could get in the first 10 teams. But you know, a seminary is not an end in itself. It's a means. And what I'm saying now is really not aimed at soliciting your interest in the seminary, though inevitably what I'm saying will glance off, and I can't be unhappy at that point. But I was talking yesterday with Tom Masaki, and I was trying to tell him how grateful I am to him and to his committee for the Mission Emphasis Week, and how grateful I am to all of the officers of the student organization for what I consider to be just about the finest atmosphere we've had on our campus. I'm not sure whether Tom was simply feeling the weight of the responsibility of trying to lift a rather inert, diverse student body into concentrated interest in missions, or whether he was feeling some of the inevitable criticism that comes from any such effort, or whether he was just being humble. I never could quite figure that out, but I tried to share with him something that I feel about the seminary. But I have to borrow one of Dr. Price's stories that he brought from Mercer University, where they abolished football and everybody was unhappy. The student newspaper was accusing the president of maybe misappropriating the funds that had been used to subsidize the football team and otherwise giving vent to some rather vigorous feelings. A member of the faculty in a certain meeting spoke up and said, "Now President Dowell will not want to say anything about this, but something has got to be done." President Dowell, one of the deans of our Southern Baptist educators, stood and smiled slightly and said, "Well, I've been in this business a long time, and I've discovered that if you don't let the students say things like that, they'll get into serious trouble." Well, you know, I told Tom that, and then said, "You know, we work at the business of trying to develop critical faculty. So we must take it for granted that there's going to be a little exercise of those faculties once they're developed. And that isn't all. The real trouble is that there's some things wrong." Now, you won't go out quoting me on that, will you? But we are not quite perfect. But here is what I was driving at. There comes the point at which you shift from simply being critical over into what is in the realm of the second mile, where you start trying to do something about it yourself. That is the mature use of critical faculties. I'm not talking against anything today. I really am right proud of you. For a little while, I thought you were going to act like college students when one of your fellow students was expelled. You know, to assume that you only were really concerned about his welfare. Maybe. Well, I doubt if any one of you lost as much sleep, let's say, as Dr. Peterson did. And I know you didn't feel any sicker at your stomach about it than I did. But I was proud of what happened as you turn that into not just asking, "Isn't there a better way to handle this?" Of course there was. But as you began to ask, "What can I do to make the thing better?" I wanted to tell you that I was grateful for your attitude and your spirit. You know, this whole business of the second mile, when you give it, you understand. I know that Jesus was talking about wrong and revenge. But was Senator Barclay too far off when he turned it to say, "You're never a free man until you go the second mile, beyond what you're compelled to do, what you have to do?" And the most important things in the world are in the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth mile. Because we don't try to put them in the first mile where you're compelled, doesn't mean at all that they are unimportant. It just means that they are so important that we dare not depend upon external compulsion, but rather somehow we are going to have to learn to operate in this realm of the new birth of a Christian experience, where men who know the truth and are thereby made free, where those who are made free by the Son are free indeed, where free men do not what they have to do, but what they can do. I could make you a speech on the level of success. Success you can buy only with the second mile. But that would put it on a very low list. Let me say instead that service starts with the second mile. I've been a pastor, but I've also been a church member, and on both counts, let me tell you, the pastoral visit that was within the pastor's duty doesn't count for much. It's the second mile that lifts the spirit and ministers to the needs of the people. May we pray. Grant, our Father, that through thy Son's revelation of eternal truth, our thinking may escape the earth-bound realities into the realm of understanding and knowledge and action that belongs to those who have been made free by that insight into the eternal truth of God. Amen.